Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I have a number of announcements today, so I wanted to get started right on time because I won't be seeing you for a couple of weeks. First of all, my name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you to Thursday Morning Roundtable. Yay! Next week, as you know, there won't be a program because it will be Thanksgiving. But since Thanksgiving makes us think of turkeys, I wanted to take this opportunity to tell you about the turkey drive that we are going to be trying to help the Salvation Army with. And you'll be getting information with your December schedule. But basically, we want to try to help the Salvation Army put together 4,000 turkeys for Christmas. So we don't have to have 4,000 turkeys by next week. But maybe by our final program on December 16th. By the way, we'll have three more programs before we take a winter break. We want to help them out as much as possible. So start, you know, thinking turkey, talking turkey, and you don't have to go out and buy turkeys necessarily, but we'll have a way for you to contribute and, again, help the Salvation Army get towards what just looks to be a growing need for helping out families this Christmas. Sort of going backwards now, on December 16th, we'll be having a panel that includes Linda Wright of the Salvation Army and a few other folks talking about the issue of homelessness in the community and how maybe it looks different than the typical, maybe we have an idea of what, you know, who the homeless are in our community, what they look like, what their situation is. And we'll be talking about the changing face of homelessness and maybe some of the ways that the recession that we're coming out of has impacted that. Backing up the week before that, Debbie Sidow, the president of OCC, will be back with us. It's been a few years since she's been here. They're going through a strategic planning process. She wants to tell us about that, some of the plans and some of the ideas, and maybe we can give her some of our own reflections. That'll be on December 9th. December 2nd, before I tell you about December 2nd, the Onondaga Citizens League, as you know, recently finished a study, What Does It Mean to Be Green? And those of you who are OCL members will be getting a copy of the printed report. For everybody else, there is a copy of the report on the website. So when we talk about what does it mean to be green, a couple of the things that we talk a lot about are land use, patterns, and transportation. On December 2nd, we have invited Paul Beyer, who is the New York State Director of Smart Growth Initiatives, to come and talk to us about those issues and what his role is and what the state is trying to do to, and I'm not going to get into the definition of smart growth, but anyway, that reminds me, if you aren't a member of the Onondaga Citizens League and you'd like a report, of course, I always have the membership flyers for you. If you're not a member, you're going to be hearing from me by mail. But if you want to save me a stamp, then see me after the meeting and I'll take you off my mailing list and just count you in as a check is in the mail kind of person. Phew! All right. That being said, again, I want to wish everybody for next week a safe and happy holiday. But right now, I'd like to introduce to you one of our newer members who will be introducing one of our also relatively new members, Greg Tripoli. But Mike LaFlair is a member of the Board of Directors of Focus Greater Syracuse. He's involved with the Syracuse 2020 Government Modernization Committee on the Town of Camillus Board of Zoning Appeals, involved with 40 Below. You get the idea. He's a civically minded young man. So, Mike, thank you. Please welcome Mike.
Thanks, Sandra. Morning, everyone. This is our speaker today, Greg Tripoli. Greg is a native of Liverpool, New York. He received his Bachelor of Arts from Hamilton College and an MBA from the University of Pittsburgh. After 4 years as a banker specializing in corporate cash management on both U.S. coast, he relocated to Italy to serve as a special assistant to the Minister of Economic Affairs for the Republic of San Marino. For the next 20 years, Mr. Tripoli traveled the world as a management consultant for a group of multinational companies headquartered in Kuwait. Since February of 2008, he has been the executive director of the Onondaga Historical Association, which operates a museum and research center in the city of Syracuse on Montgomery Street. Mr. Tripoli is also Vice President of Cathedral Square Development Corporation, a member of the Arts and Cultural Leadership Alliance, and the Cathedral Square Neighborhood Association. He serves on the Board of Directors of the Downtown Committee of Syracuse, the Advisory Board of Art in Motion, and several committees for Syracuse University's Southside Initiative, the Connective Corridor, and Syracuse Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Tripoli is a 2010 recipient of the YWCA's Academy of Diversity Achievers Award. He currently resides in the city of Syracuse and at Montario Point on the shores of Lake Ontario in Jefferson County. So with that, welcome Greg Tripoli.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, everybody. You know, it's been a while since I've been up here at the podium. When I first started at OHA about two and a half years ago, I had the pleasure of introducing Joni Mahoney here. And I looked out, and I really didn't know anybody in the room. And now I look out, I see so many friendly faces, so it's very comforting. The OHA, as many of you know, is the repository for many of the paintings and the artifacts and the documents that chronicle the great entrepreneurial history of our community. But we're also actively engaged in developing the entrepreneurial history of the future. We're acutely aware that the economic future, our economic future, is inextricably linked to the economic prosperity of the community that we serve. And that's why a good portion of our strategic plan is geared to a more entrepreneurial approach to running the operations of OHA, but also in using history to contribute to the economic development of our community. In addition to adding value to community projects like the Creek Walk and the Connective Corridor and parks throughout our county, we're also using historic perspective to add value to many companies and organizations by creating custom exhibits which highlight the company's heritage and also their contribution not only to their industry but to our community as well. These exhibits can also add value to specific products and services, like the exhibit that we did last season for a Syracuse stage and their production of Little Women, in which we emphasized the local connection to the author Louisa May Alcott, as well as to the themes and activities inherent in the production, providing a more familiar perspective and a more palpable connection to the production for the audience. This particular exhibit on Louisa May Alcott is now on tour at the Onondaga County Public Library System with a reading program and a selection of books that create a literacy history component. The exhibit will be touring for the entire year, and this season we're doing four exhibits for Syracuse Stage. OHA is also making a more tangible and direct contribution to economic development in our community. We were actively engaged in finding a tenant for the restaurant space next door to our building, and we're sponsoring a new history-themed museum-related retail store later in the spring of 2011. These efforts are in direct response to what the community has told us what they need in order to come downtown more often. Fewer vacant spaces, more restaurants, and more stores. We'll be restoring the facade of our historic building in 2011, which will add to the aesthetic attractiveness of our city. They'll enhance the pedestrian experience on Montgomery Street and improve the use and function of a historic building. This helps attract residents, visitors, and investment in our downtown area, all of which directly contribute to economic development. We're active charter members of the Cathedral Square Neighborhood Association, and we're a founding board member of the Cathedral Square Development Corporation, which is dedicated to encouraging investment and development in our historic neighborhood. Through our living history programs, like Evening at the Museum, we're making history more entertaining. We're also making the great stories of our local community more accessible through our unprecedented number of off-site satellite exhibits, cell phone tours, our publications like our regular features in Central New York Magazine, and our news magazine, History Highlights, which is on all of the tables here this morning, along with some other information on upcoming programs and, of course, membership information. These efforts will expand in the new year due to collaborations that we're finalizing with the New Times, Clear Channels Radio, and WCNY, where we'll tell the compelling stories of our local history through regular newspaper columns, radio shows, and television programming. We're partnering with local entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial programs in our local schools to provide young entrepreneurs and students with real-world experience. And we developed an entrepreneurial educational program, which uses history to help encourage entrepreneurship. The study and knowledge of our great local entrepreneurial history can not only create pride in our past and create a determination to want to leave and build a legacy that's worthy of our great heritage, it can also inspire individuals to take the risk, follow the dream, work hard, and pursue their passions by starting a business. In a larger context, the study of our country's history shows the depth of America's entrepreneurial roots. A work ethic that's based on self-determination has always been a part of our history from the days of Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton. From the American Revolution to the settlement of the Western frontier to the assembly line to the internet, our ability and willingness to take risks, adapt, invent, innovate, and to support new concepts have helped us build and maintain the most successful economy in the world. The American Revolution was not instigated by an uprising of the masses, nor was it fueled by intellectual theory. It was led by entrepreneurial men of means who, through their entrepreneurial experiences, learned the importance of independence, hard work, self-discipline, and of working with others, as well as the recognition that you only succeed by serving the needs of others. From our history, we know that these abilities lie at the very heart of our national character. A review of American history cements the contention that entrepreneurship has always been and continues to be our central comparative advantage. A review of our local history brings to mind names like Alexander T. Brown, who, with over 300 patents to his name, he invented everything from the automobile differential to the automated telephone switchboard, and at one point served almost simultaneously as the president of L.C. Smith Typewriter Company, for whom he invented the Smith Premier Typewriter, the Franklin Automobile Company, and Brown Leib Chapin, who made most of the gears for General Motors, most of those gears invented by Brown. There are also names like Mary Elizabeth Evans, who was the youngest businesswoman in the United States at the turn of the last century, when at 15 years old, she started a company to make candy, first on Burnett Avenue, then on South Salina Street, and ending with one of the most famous and most exclusive restaurants on Fifth Avenue in New York City. Or Melville Clark, who not only ran one of the most successful and largest music stores in the country from right here in Syracuse, and was an accomplished musician who headlined at the White House for three different presidents, he also invented everything from the fruit picker to the amplifier to the individually temperature-controlled refrigerator compartments. Our local history is filled with people like these, samples of what it takes and what it means to be an entrepreneur. Thomas Friedman, who's a famous columnist for the New York Times, wrote an article recently. It was entitled Time to Inspire Innovation. And in that article, he stated that we need to get millions of American kids, not just the geniuses, excited about innovation and entrepreneurship again. History can help achieve this by highlighting examples from our own community to show that it's not necessary to be a genius in order to be an entrepreneur. Too much emphasis is placed on that one new technology or that new product that no one has ever thought of before. The vast majority of time, growth and value emerge not from technology or intellectual property, but from process innovation or improved process. That is, making something better, faster, cheaper, or more valuable. The economist Paul Romer says that economic growth occurs whenever people take resources and rearrange them in ways that are more valuable. In the end, it's the old-fashioned process change that creates lasting value, not that one big idea. In other words, the entrepreneur trumps technology in creating lasting value. After all, Ford didn't invent the automobile. Dell didn't invent the computer. On a local level, we can demonstrate process innovation by showing that Franklin didn't invent the air-cooled engine. Smith didn't invent the typewriter, as we just heard. And Marcellus certainly didn't invent the casket. Yet they were all tremendously successful entrepreneurs who helped build our local economy. And the capital derived from some of these businesses is still being used today to help foster new business growth. Most new jobs in any local economy are produced by the community's small local businesses. And this means that we need to encourage and inspire entrepreneurship on a local level to build our local economy. The compelling stories of our local entrepreneurs can serve as case studies to improve judgment in the uncertain environment of entrepreneurial pursuits. They can provide that local connection with someone who had nothing but an idea in an economic, legal, and social environment that was less conducive than today's, took that leap and made it work. Jeremy Levine, who's a well-known venture capitalist, points out that entrepreneurs get inspired to take the risk and start a company at some point in their careers. And the likelihood of being inspired goes up significantly when you're in an environment where you see others who got inspired and were successful. Now, you've already heard me mention Alexander Brown, Mary Elizabeth Evans, and Melville Clark, who are just three of the great stories that we highlight in our entrepreneurship program. But today I want to give you a glimpse into another segment of our program, one of the great inspirational entrepreneurial stories from our local history is that of the Schubert brothers. A trio of brothers, Lee, Sam, and J.J. Schubert, from a dirt-poor immigrant family with seven kids, the Schuberts grew up in Syracuse during the late 19th century. Their abusive, lazy father, who was averse to work and addicted to alcohol, pulled them out of school and put them on the streets when they were about 8 or 9 years old to become the principal breadwinners for the family. The boys began their career by selling newspapers, shining shoes, and hawking theater programs in front of the city's theaters. They were bright, they were industrious, and their early responsibility helped develop a sort of street smart shrewdness. In spite of their father, or perhaps because of him, in their desire to avoid the shame and the poverty that he caused them, they stayed clear of alcohol, and they developed rigorous work ethics. For their entire lives, they worked regularly, 14 to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. Their example underscores the lesson that passion, hard work, determination, and industriousness are the basic elements for any successful entrepreneur. By their early teens, they'd worked their way up through the box office and treasury positions at the three top theaters in town. By their late teens, they were managing those theaters and starting to produce tours of hit New York shows. Using Syracuse as their base, and the financial resources of several Syracuse entrepreneurial businessmen and a few rich widows, the Schuberts expanded their operations first across upstate New York, then across the country, eventually building the largest theatrical empire that this world has ever seen. In fact, if any of you have ever been to a Broadway show, the chances are you saw that show in a Schubert theater. Though the last brother died in 1963, the Schubert organization is still thriving. It owns currently 17 landmark Broadway theaters, making it the largest theater owner on Broadway today. The Schuberts didn't invent theater. They were imitators and innovators who developed novel methods of promoting and producing theater to make it better, faster, and cheaper, while catering to the needs of the public. They were, in fact, process innovators. Typical of most entrepreneurial ventures, the Schubert brothers experienced plenty of failure and setbacks, some of them seemingly insurmountable, including devastating personal tragedy, bankruptcy, and of course their fair share of production flops. But they learned from those failures and persevered to achieve consistently greater success. Failure is a part of the entrepreneurial process. It's almost inevitable, but it doesn't define the true entrepreneur. At the time the Schuberts were starting in the theater business, there was a powerful, brutal monopoly known as the American Theatrical Syndicate that controlled the entire theater business across the United States, from actors and producers, authors and prop hands. Without consideration for what the public wanted to see, the syndicate determined what and who appeared on local stages around the country. The Schuberts advocated an open-door policy that encouraged competition and opportunities for other independent producers, actors, and theater owners. When the Schuberts began management of their first theater, which was the Bastable Theater here in Syracuse, that was where the State Tower building now stands, the syndicate blocked the big-name actors and shows from showing at the Bastable. So the brothers got creative. They resorted to a then-defunct tradition of establishing a local stock company using local performers. The Schuberts kept their ears to the ground, and they knew what the public wanted. So they played to the developing appetite for sensationalism, extravagance, and spectacle in a more upscale version of the vaudeville genre. The Schubert story emphasizes the basic entrepreneurial concept that you only succeed by serving the needs of others. They knew what the public wanted, and they gave it to them, despite the prevailing conventional wisdom that vaudeville and stock companies were passé. They relied on production pizzazz and magnetic marketing to take an old idea and through innovation made it new again, with improvements and adjustments that catered to the public taste. When they couldn't book a syndicate theater for their national tour of the wildly popular actress Sarah Bernhardt, they presented her in a circus tent. The stunt provided tons of free press. It heightened public sentiment against the syndicate, and Bernhardt's tour sold out. The tent allowed a capacity of hundreds more than any theater, and it deprived the syndicate of enormous profit percentages. Their actions are consistent with entrepreneurial principles espoused today by Michael Levin, CEO of Titan Steel Corporation and the entrepreneur in residence of the Kauffman Foundation. He states that marketing skills and individuals' ability to recognize and capitalize on opportunity are the great wealth creators and the triggers for sustainable value creation. With the advantage of not having to pay 50% of their profits to the syndicate, the Schuberts were also able to make their shows available at a much cheaper price. Contrary to typical production practices at the time, the Schuberts used innovative financing for their business, and unlike the syndicate, the Schuberts developed partnerships, and they employed outside capital to fuel a rapid expansion. When they couldn't find a theater willing to take a chance on someone who wasn't connected to the syndicate, the Schuberts resorted to another innovative alternative that the syndicate refused to employ. They built their own, again, with Syracuse investors' money. Syracuse entrepreneurs used the capital from their own successful businesses to help the Schuberts build and sustain their growing empire. Men like Joseph Jacobs, a local Syracuse clothier, and Aaron Graff, who owned the largest furniture store on South Salina Street, and Jesse Oberdorfer, who was heir to a local foundry. These people provided the initial and continual financial support, becoming richer themselves in the process. The great philanthropist Margaret Olivia Slocum Sage assisted her fellow Syracusans, the Schuberts, by helping to expand their New York City properties, and she earned a good rate of return in the process. Syracuse also provided a good deal of the managerial, legal, and artistic skills that helped build the Schubert Empire. Syracusans like David Finestone and Marcus Hyman held management positions in the Schubert organization for their entire lives. Syracuse's Philip Lennon provided advertising expertise, and local attorney Robert Rubin became their legal advisor. The Schuberts also mined the depths of the local talent pool, making international stars out of Syracuse's Beulah Chase Dodge and Edna May. These relationships provide additional examples of the basic elements that are involved in entrepreneurial success: mentoring, networking, and partnerships. Bo Fishback, who's vice president of entrepreneurship at the Kauffman Foundation, states that networking is crucial to every aspect of entrepreneurship. The most successful entrepreneurs have frequent, extensive contacts with people in various fields and industries that could conceivably relate to their work. They provide insights that can help the entrepreneur spot and act upon unclaimed opportunities. They are, of course, also successful in recruiting talent, investors, partners, advisors, and customers for the venture. Around 1903, the Schuberts moved the base of their operations from Syracuse to New York City, which, of course, is the capital of theater in the United States. They launched a full frontal attack on the syndicate and continued to build their alliances with producers, playwrights, and actors to support their contention that every theater should have the freedom to book attractions that meet the needs and the desires of its own public. Sam Schubert, who was the middle brother, was the leader of the group. It was really his vision. He was the one who had the passion for theater. He was incredibly charismatic. So we had one of these great personalities that people were just attracted to. They fell in love with him in the first 30 seconds. We've all met people like that. He was the guy who convinced the big name actors to come in. And Sam knew that no matter what you were producing, if you had a big name, people would come. He was the one that convinced the investors to invest in the Schuberts and the producers to leave the syndicate and produce their shows in a Schubert theater. Lee, who was the older brother, was always very immaculately dressed. He was very aloof, almost overly polite, kind of cold. The youngest brother, JJ, was the largest of the three, and it was a little rough around the edges. He was kind of boisterous. He had a bad temper, which occasionally erupted into pugnaciousness. But Sam was really the glue that held the three of them together. In May of 1905, Sam, who was on his way to Pittsburgh to testify in a hearing against the syndicate over a theater there, the Duquesne Theater, his train collided with a work train carrying dynamite. Sam died of his injuries the next day at a mere 29 years old. Talk about a major setback. The brothers then had to decide what they were going to do. So hot and cold came together, creating the perfect temperature to make this budding empire bloom. And bloom it did. They increased their attacks against the syndicate and continued their rapid expansion. They won that fight for the Duquesne Theater in Pittsburgh, and they dedicated it and every other theater to the memory of their brother Sam by hanging his portrait in the lobby. In fact, all of the theaters had different names, but technically, legally, they're all known as the Samuel S. Schubert Memorial Theater. Since the syndicate controlled the theater-related press, the brothers published their own magazine called the New York Review that reported on the New York theater scene, and they took their battle public via the press. Of course, the New York Review gave rave reviews to all the Schubert shows and trashed all the syndicate shows. By their very nature, entrepreneurs are agents of change. And entrepreneurship is the ultimate manifestation of individual freedom. The Schuberts were relentless in their efforts to free their industry from the stranglehold of the syndicate. By the dawn of the Roaring Twenties, the syndicate was dead. Competition was once again king, and the Schuberts began their reign over the heyday of American theater. The Schuberts are emblematic of another hallmark of successful entrepreneurs: vision, and the ability to anticipate and adapt to the future. When the Schuberts first went to New York in the early 1900s, the theater district was centered below 35th Street. In fact, their first theater was the Herald Square Theater at 35th, where Macy's now stands. And everybody in New York thought that's way too far north for anybody to make success out of it. But the brothers somehow foresaw that the future of the New York theater district would be uptown, around Times Square, then known as Longacre Square, and really in a relatively undeveloped area. Still investing considerable sums of Syracuse money, the Schuberts concentrated on building and buying theaters in the west side from 41st to 49th streets. Eventually, by the early 20s, the Schuberts owned everything on 44th and 45th Street between 8th Avenue and Broadway. That comprised the single most valuable parcel of theatrical real estate in the world and is, of course, what we all know as the heart of Broadway today. The Schuberts continued their entrepreneurial practice of process innovation in one of their most successful ventures, The Passing Show. The series of musical reviews, The Passing Shows, competed directly with the Ziegfeld Follies of Florence Ziegfeld. But whereas Ziegfeld agonized over every little detail of his productions, producing an entire new show for every season, the Schuberts created an almost assembly line technique for their passing shows, changing out sets and costumes and scenery and songs to create their new shows. Capitalizing on and repeating what resonated with the audiences, the passing shows were tremendously popular and made lots of money. Ziegfeld was an artistic perfectionist. The Schuberts were entrepreneurial businessmen who had deep-pocketed, long-established investors who expected a return on their investment. I like to tell the story of a costume designer who may have worked for the Ziegfeld at one point, was working for the Schuberts, and tried to convince Mr. Schubert to add another ruffle to one of the costumes. Mr. Schubert said, "Well, why? Who's going to notice?" And the designer said, "But it'll make the costume better." Mr. Schubert said, "I agree it'll make the costume better. But like I said, who's going to notice?" And the costume designer said, but Mr. Schubert, it's only a dollar. Mr. Schubert said, a dollar? I got 50 girls in this show. I got 20 shows on the road. What's a dollar for you is $1,000 for me. The ruffle's out. And probably the costume designer was out as well. Ziegfeld would most likely have agreed with the costume designer. He might have added an additional ruffle to the costume. But in the end, Ziegfeld died broke. The Schuberts bought the rights to Ziegfeld's name from his widow and continued to produce the Ziegfeld shows under the Ziegfeld Follies name, but this time with the Schubert formula, and they made millions. The Schubert organization still owns the rights to the name Ziegfeld Follies. Though their inaccurate reputation paints them as greedy, cold-hearted, selfish profit-mongers, the Schuberts were actually very generous and philanthropic. And instead of lining their own very deep pockets, they gave back to their industry through the Schubert organization, and they gave back to their community through the Schubert Foundation, thus providing examples of the ultimate altruistic aim of the socially conscious entrepreneur, providing seed money for future entrepreneurs. As I mentioned, the Schubert organization is still currently by far the largest theater owner on Broadway, and the foundation that they started is currently the largest foundation of its kind in the world, founding and funding regional theater all across the country, including being one of the largest single contributors to our own Syracuse stage. The Schubert story is just one of the great entrepreneurial stories that are housed at OHA that can be used as case studies to help encourage, teach, and inspire entrepreneurs in our own community. And knowledge of their story will help produce a feeling of pride every time a Syracuse resident sits in one of those amazingly beautiful theaters to experience the thrill and the spectacle of a Broadway show, knowing that the money, the ingenuity, the people, and the entrepreneurial spirit from Syracuse helped build that theater and Broadway as we know it today. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I'm sure we have some questions.
This coming year is a significant event coming up, the 150th anniversary this April of the beginning of the Civil War. Are you guys planning anything surrounding that and for the course of the next 4 years?
Yes, quite a few things. We've just opened a new exhibit on the Civil War. It's kind of a primer. We'll be expanding that exhibit as the year goes on, adding more and more things. We're collaborating with the Civil War Roundtable to produce a number of different events, hopefully a parade sort of thing from the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial in Clinton Square, which originally was intended to be a memorial to the Civil War soldiers, using Civil War reenactment people. We're starting in April, which is when the Civil War started. We are starting Twitter. We're going to tweet every day. We have some amazing Civil War diaries at the OHA and great Civil War stories from local people. And some of those are really compelling. So every day we're going to tweet a line or two from a diary of a local boy who was serving in the Civil War. As time goes on throughout the year, we'll tell story of him and his family, and we'll get to know him a little bit. And every day we will read another line from his diary and follow his life through the Civil War. So we're planning a number of different things to coincide with that.
I was curious. We have the Erie Canal Museum and the OHA, both very active as far as the community is concerned. Would there be any advantage to them merging into a single organization?
You know, that I think that issue has been brought up several times in the past, and that's really a board decision. It's not a decision that's made on a staff level or executive director. So I'll leave that up to the boards and the county who funds both organizations partially to decide.
Greg, you mentioned when you started out the Cathedral Square Organization and Development Organization, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the vision for that area. I know you've done some things and But what's the vision?
Well, you know, we're looking at we started to build a board, number one, and then we did sort of an inventory of the Cathedral Square neighborhood, and we're looking at how we might be able to consolidate certain services and to serve the neighborhood better. And obviously what we're looking for is active development, and in the neighborhood there's a lot of empty spaces there, and so we're just kind of right now doing an inventory, looking at the neighborhood as a whole and all of the organizations and services that are in the neighborhood. And we have a few projects that we have that we're pursuing, but nothing really to announce yet. It's just great to have a neighborhood association and an organization with a very active board that is looking intensely at the center of our city, which heretofore has never had a group that looks at that. But we're all doing things independently. Those of us on Montgomery Street are actively involved in trying to improve development on our street, as I said, you know, with the restaurant next door and the store at the OHA, and they're putting a new sewer system in now, so we had certain drainage issues, and it was easy for the city to be able to go to one organization and say, we're about to start this project. Is there anything that we need to look at in particularly? And we worked very closely with the city, and we're a liaison between the city and the neighbors. And that's there's never been an organization that was able to do that before in that very historic neighborhood.
There are a number of very active community outside of in the suburban area that are working consistently and could provide a lot of material for you. What is your relationship with the various historical associations in Spofford and in Skaneateles and in Fayetteville and Camillus? Do you have any?
We have a great relationship with those historical societies. I think traditionally, you know, it hasn't been all that close, but we've really reached out to all of them. I attend all of their meetings as a representative from OHA. I have offered to provide links to their websites and free loans from our collection to help boost exhibits for them. For those who don't have a venue, I've offered OHA as a venue for them to have exhibits. And we're talking about now that we're about to undergo a major construction project at OHA, which will develop a number of new different temporary galleries. And so I'm talking to the local historical societies in hopes that they would like to use some of those galleries to mount exhibits. And we understand the desire and the need for these local historical societies to collect and preserve the history of those local communities, and we encourage that, and we work very closely together.
Congratulations on your leadership that you brought. I'm wondering if there are any plans for another collaborative event like the Turner de Cezanne that rallied all the local arts and historical associations to promote.
Yes, I believe very firmly that the answer to boosting the art and cultural heritage community in this community is to work together, to collaborate, to build each other up, and to support each other. We need to get the community, and particularly the legislature and the government entities, to thinking of us as an industry that works together to add value to this community. And as an industry, we're a tremendous economic development engine here. And we are collaborating with almost every art and cultural organization. We're working with the Everson on a very large exhibit coming up in the spring of 2012. Steve Kern is a great friend of mine, and we had a wonderful collaborative relationship with Turner de Cezanne, where OHA presented an exhibit that talked about what was going on here locally during the time that those masterpieces that were shown at the Everson were being created. As I mentioned, we've upped our collaboration with Syracuse Stage this year to four different exhibits. Those exhibits then go on to the Onondaga County Public Library, adding value to their organization. We look forward to collaborating with every single one of our partners in the art and cultural heritage industry, and we have lots of things on the burners. Right now, the symphony, which is just, you know, phenomenal organization here, adds so much to our community, is celebrating its 50th anniversary. When you go to the symphony, you'll see a very large four-panel exhibit that was produced by OHA to mark the 50 years of the symphony. So we collaborate with, we are always looking for opportunities to collaborate with our partners in that industry.
It's clear we have a very rich and a formidable history here in Syracuse, and the stories of entrepreneurship and the success of our local entrepreneurs were very inspiring. But what would you say are the critical qualities that would allow someone to be a successful entrepreneur? You've alluded to them. And how then do we use these stories to actually engender those or promote those in our youth?
Well, you know, we don't get into the details of how you start a business. I mean, it's quite simple, actually. And for the United States, you know, you can almost start a business in an afternoon on the internet these days. We do talk about the social environments, the economic environments, about why it's more conducive today than to start a business, comparing it to history. But I think that the most important thing is to use this program. Not only encourages entrepreneurship because it talks about the basic things that are needed in order to be a successful entrepreneur, but it also tells a great compelling story about our history. And as I mentioned in the piece, it's statistically, it's known that if someone, there are a lot of people who are sort of sitting on that fence, who are thinking about, should I start a business, and you know, what would that be? And statistically, it's proven that if they continue to hear stories about people from their own backyard who took that risk, made that leap, and were successful, they're much, much more likely to do it themselves. And so I think, you know, using history as a guide, we can tell those stories and help encourage in that way to just say, you know, you're not alone. And these people did it in times that were much more difficult, with facilities and capabilities that were perhaps much less than what you have. And they made it work. But you need to do these things. You need to work hard. You need to think about how you can take something and make it better. A lot of kids particularly, I think, are concerned with start, you know, if they start a business or to be an entrepreneur, they've got to invent that thing that no one's ever heard of before, this new thing. That's so not true. Really, the great value creator is process innovation. And I think so many of us, no matter if it's we go to a store, we go to a restaurant, we see another business, we think, I could do better. You know, I can make something better. I can make it faster. I can make it cheaper. I can make it more valuable somehow. It's not about that one big idea that no one ever thought of before. So we take these rules, if you will, of how to become a successful entrepreneur, and by applying them to these great compelling stories, we kind of hit two birds with one stone.
Greg, it might be premature to ask this, but I know a lot of us were asked to fill out a survey for the Ideas Collaborative, arts, culture, entertainment, led by a bunch of funders, including the Gifford Foundation. And, in terms of audience development, in addition to the working together idea with other organizations, has anything come out of that yet? I know there's a report due out, and maybe we'll hear more about it next year. But
not too much yet. It's pretty preliminary. But what we're looking, you know, we've seen a little bit of some of the cross the sharing of audience that we have with some other organizations, but they haven't really presented any firm final results from that study. So, and it'll be a while. It was like a year and a half long process.
We'll hear more about it later, I think.
My question goes to budget. What kind of budget you work with to stay in operation? Do you try to get sponsors for a lot of your exhibits or all of your exhibits? How do you determine whether you're going to charge or maybe not charge for a particular exhibit and things like that?
Well, our budget is about $1 million a year. We're dedicated to keeping our museum as our main community service free to the public. And, I'm glad you asked that question, actually. You know, many people know that the county, who provides a certain amount of assistance every year, which is as it should, because we are basically collecting, preserving, exhibiting, cataloging the history of the county. OHA is not a discretionary art and cultural heritage organization. We have no control over the amount of history that's being developed and being created. Every single day, things come to OHA in a manila envelope filled with photographs, in a box full of stuff, in a trunk load full of stuff, or in the case of Syracuse, China, in six tractor trailer loads full of stuff. Now, that's a good example, actually. I'd like to use Syracuse, China about that, because everybody here knows Syracuse, China. Now, when Syracuse, China went out of business, they have a great historical collection and all of their paperwork, and we had just gotten our funding cut by the county by 20%. We're constantly trying, like other art and cultural organizations, heritage organizations, trying to do more with less. And we could have said very easily, you know, we don't have the ability to take that. I mean, how do we do that? We can't add staff. That collection came with absolutely no money. And, you know, we just can't do that. We're not an organization that can say, you know, that's a lovely painting and we'd love to add it to our collection, but times being what they are and the economy being what it is, we just can't afford to do that. If that painting is historically significant, we have to take it. That's our job. That's our mission. With Syracuse, China, I fought for that collection. It's kind of, you know, be careful what you ask for. But the point is that Syracuse, China is 140 years of the most phenomenal local history that had international implications. You can follow American and international history through Syracuse, China. They made the advent of transportation. They made China for all the railroads and the airlines and steamship lines, hotels all across the world. Just talk about entrepreneurship. The company itself was at the forefront of marketing and manufacturing, design, employee relations. They were one of the first to have a standard employee relations program called Industrial Humanics about how to recruit and maintain a highly skilled workforce. The history that is inherent in that collection, in that company, is so special to this community. And when you see that collection, you see American history in the changes in design and tastes and trends, domestic life, in the most beautiful, spectacular way, something that we all can relate to as well, China, something that we use, that has also historical implications for ourselves, for our own family, something that's handed down from generation to generation. We couldn't say no to that. And yet, how do you take on six tractor trailer loads, tens of thousands of pieces of China, every memo that was ever written, every order form that was ever ordered for Syracuse, China, and then to take it, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we do with those. Every single piece of China, every cup, every saucer, every plate, we take that piece, we research it, we backtrack it to its paperwork, we find out who ordered it, when they ordered it, what they ordered it for, why, if what sort of significance it has. We photograph it front and back. We repack it, we catalog it, we store it, and we document all of that information. It's going to take us years to go through that. How do we pay for it? Well, there are membership forms on all of your tables. We do have members, and the magazine that you see there, History Highlights, is one of the great benefits of membership. It's an only member benefit. You have to be a member in order to get that. The membership is very inexpensive, but we have fundraisers. We do speaking engagements. We do customized exhibits. We've started, you know, a number of different fee service business lines so that we can increase our revenue. We're opening that store in downtown that we hope will increase revenue from us. We're looking at a more, as I said, a more entrepreneurial approach to running OHA. But like all organizations like ours, we will always have to rely on the community to help support us. And as I said, you know, the county, which is really our largest customer, we are collecting and preserving the history of the county, are continually reducing their portion of that. They pay a very, very small portion of what it costs to actually collect and preserve that that history. So we're having to be creative and look for other ways. And yes, we do look for sponsors for the exhibit. That sponsor for Syracuse Stage, for example, I go out and I look for a company to sponsor that. But it's really a great deal. I mean, you're helping three great community service nonprofits, OHA, Syracuse Stage, and the Onondaga County Public Library System. For a very relatively small amount of money, you're providing a great educational exhibit for the community. With the Onondaga County Public Library on board, there's a literacy component involved. Those exhibits reach conservatively about 500,000 people during the time that they're going through the community. That's a great PR and marketing opportunity for that company. It's about giving something to them instead of just going around with our handout.
Greg, you mentioned arts and cultural organizations a lot. Is there space for charitable organizations' history? Like, I just learned the other day that the Girl Scouts are having their 100th anniversary in Syracuse. And I think that things like that ought to be part of life in our area.
We agree. And we're talking to the Girl Scouts about doing an exhibit to mark their 100th anniversary. And yes, we do exhibits for a lot of these organizations, particularly charitable organizations. We're talking of Ark of Onondaga right now about doing an exhibit for them. We're talking to Enable about doing an exhibit to mark their anniversary. We look for every opportunity that we possibly can to highlight the great organizations, charitable, profit, and nonprofit in our community, and to talk about their great heritage, put them in a context of a larger context of state and national history, and to tell their employees and the rest of the citizens of our community what they've contributed to not only their own industry but to our community in general.
Greg, in addition to becoming a member, is OHA an organization that can effectively use more volunteers, or and in general, what kind of role do volunteers play?
Boy, we love our volunteers. They're just amazing, and we could never do what we do without our volunteer corps. They're incredible people who are so dedicated, not just to OHA, but they're really dedicated to this community, and We look for every way possible to make their time at OHA fun and rewarding, and I can't say enough about how much they mean to us and the value that they add to our organization and so many others that don't have the funds and that are necessary in order to do what we do. Ann Messenger. You know, when I first came back to Syracuse, New York, and I wanted to do something here and to change careers and to do something different, everybody told me that I needed to talk to Ann Messenger. And Ann Messenger just was so helpful to me in helping to and to talking to me and consulting me about a career change and what I could do. And I gave her this really crazy, wild resume. One that I certainly hadn't done in about 27 years, and she put it together in a very coherent form and then pointed me in the direction of where I needed to go in order to find something here that would be challenging and rewarding for me. And really, I can't say enough about how much I owe Ann Messenger.
Does she have a question?
So be gentle with your question.
Wow. Thank you for those kind words, Greg. Your mind never ceases to amaze me, honestly. Again and again, I've heard of people who've come back to Syracuse for whatever reason. I keep thinking that the newspaper, you need to do a story on these folks. You're my poster child for people who come back. You have an extraordinary business background. you have now this worldview that you've returned to Syracuse with and have put to work. I'm told that you'll never run for mayor.
And the reason I need so much closet space is for all my skeletons.
And your shoes, too.
Yeah, right, yes, I'm a shoe freak.
Tell us, why did you come back? And with this worldview, can you give us a nugget or two about how we can... I feel as if Syracuse is on the edge of becoming great again. How do we do that?
I believe you're right. I believe Syracuse is on the edge of coming back. It takes a village, and there is a national trend towards moving back to urban environments, and I think that's the key to making Syracuse great again. Because the reason why I came back to Central New York is because I love Central New York, and I'm very close with my family. I have always lived millions of miles away from them, and so I wanted to be near my family again, and I wanted to come back to Central New York. I've had a home here since 1987, and just was not able to come back as often as I liked. It was the place that I always loved to come back to and always hated to leave, and I felt that this state is so phenomenal, and upstate New York is so beautiful, the natural beauty, the great organizations that we have, the amazing history that we have. We have everything that we need here in order to become great again. The one thing that we're lacking, we have wonderful suburban areas and incredible countryside and mountains and beaches and Olympic venues, skiing and lakes, and what we don't have is a strong heart. And if you don't have a strong heart, just like a person, a community begins to die at the extremities. And in order to really build our entire community again, we need to create a strong urban core. And this, I think, is what I've learned from my worldview and traveling around the world, is that the really great sustainable communities have a strong urban core. And so that's one of the things that I wanted to do, was to do whatever I could to try to contribute to rebuilding our strong urban core. And we can do that. OHA has a large role to play in that, not only about what we're doing in our own neighborhood, in our city, and our contributions to the community with getting involved in economic development and other organizations, but by using history, our amazing, phenomenal history, to help create that pride in who we are and where we've been. And when you do create that pride, you do create a determination to want to build and leave a legacy that's worthy of that great heritage. And that's how we can use history to contribute to building our entire community again.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Greg Tripoli.
Thanks very much.